so.
So I thought what I would use as a takeoff point tonight is, what is the point or the purpose of what we're doing here, which is called Zen practice? What is its purpose? Now, just to define Zen, I want to go back to its root, which is a Sanskrit word, dhyana. Dhyana, it means absorption or deep mindfulness. So you notice that this is the essence, and Zen practice is the practice of deep mindfulness. So nothing in this is pointing at a set of beliefs, a creed, an identity, something that you become. It's pointing at more like, I would say, a method. So it's not, strictly speaking, in the ordinary sense, a religion, although it shares some things with religions. The most basic thing it shares is a word called faith. Now, this is not belief. Faith is the sense, the intuitive sense, the deep sense that you're on the right track. So I can say that everyone in this room, even the people sitting for the very first time, already have faith. If you didn't have faith, you wouldn't be here. So there's some part of you that said, this, I sense, is the direction I need to go. It's that simple. And as you continue down the path, the faith gets much clearer and much stronger and much better defined, I would say. Now, why do people come here? We're talking about the purpose of this practice. What is the reason that people will come here? Not just newcomers, but experienced people. Now, I can honestly say I've never seen anyone come here whose life was so perfect that it was like a hot fudge sundae with a big mound of whipped cream on top, and this practice was going to be the cherry on top of it all. That's just not why people come here. It's not to make a perfect life even more perfect. People come here because they sense in a deep way, first, that there's something missing, something not right, something that is creating pain, sense of separation, maybe a sense of frustration. I said first of all, but there's a deeper part to this. It's that all the ways that ordinary life offers to solve this sense of incompleteness are not doing it. And you don't know why. I should just have a lot of friends, and I should just, you know, make a lot of money, and I should just be happy, but I can't. So some people, just by accident, they trip over this practice. Somehow, you know, a friend mentions it, or they pick up a book, and it resonates. Now, this is the very beginning, the first twinkling of what I called faith. Something resonates. Oh, maybe this is what I need to do. Now, let's go a little bit deeper into this. So, it's quite the norm that people will feel a sense of frustration, incompleteness, pain. Matter of fact, the Buddha put it this way, the very first noble truth is life is dukkha. Dukkha is Sanskrit for suffering, incompleteness, unsatisfactoriness. The Buddha recognizes a very essence of the human condition. It's the essence of the human condition. It's not unique to you or me or anyone else in this room. It is the essence of the human condition that life, you know, this world of ever-changing forms of all kinds, is incomplete, unsatisfactory. Now, it would be very easy to come here and then say, well, this is going to be the solution, this is going to fix my unsatisfactory life. And then the Zen practice in someone's mind becomes a way to fix themselves. It becomes a self-improvement project. Now, there's some very useful aspects to meditation. One of them, I talked with one of you tonight about mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was actually created by a person, John Cabot, who's now very famous. He's written many books. I actually saw his very first lecture on this. It was a proposal for this at the place that originated, which was the University of Massachusetts Medical School in Worcester, Mass. I went to his talk with about 10 other people in a big, empty lecture hall. After classes were over, he was my anatomy instructor. He was not a doctor, he was an anatomist. And he talked about this mindfulness-based stress reduction, which privately to me, he said, was subversive Buddhism. I'm going to have Buddhism enter the ivory tower. So this practice can be used as a kind of self-help. But in my experience, that's limiting it severely. For a couple of reasons. Number one is, in order to embark on a self-help project, you have to have a checker seeing if it's working. If you're moving from a standpoint of brokenness to a point of fixing yourself. So you're introducing into this absorption practice a watcher, and the watcher is actually working against the process. So I think that's a real limitation, although most of us perhaps seek this practice for that reason. If we don't catch on to a deeper resonation with it, many people who are doing this self-improvement project will eventually leave because something else, some other shiny object will be dangled in front of their face that will work faster, work better, and then they'll say, well, I guess Zen practice didn't do it for me. I'm just not made out for it. But they started with a premise that was pointing them in the wrong direction, pointing them outward at the characteristics of themselves, seeing if the characteristics are getting improved. They're getting more calm, more social, less afraid, more happy, things like that. Now, the deeper aspect to this is that no matter how hard you try, you can't completely fix yourself in this way. The Buddha said all component things are subject to decay, including everything that you identify with, your personality, your circumstances, your friendships, your loves. All these things are subject to decay. You may get all your ducks lined up in a roll, in a row on some lucky day, and then the next day the ducks have all gone out of their row. And that's just the nature of human life. So for those two reasons. Now, so what is the purpose? I want to just read you something from a wonderful contemporary master who died a few years ago of cancer. I found this in a book I've been reading called Bare Bones Meditation. This is written by Joan Tollefson, who's a wonderful, very unique spiritual teacher who's fundamental practice is actually Zen, but she doesn't call herself a Zen Buddhist, which is totally fine. So in one of her chapters here, she quotes a contemporary Zen master, now dead. His name was Suzuki Roshi. And this is what he wrote. He wrote, "In Zazen, what you are doing is not for the sake of anything. It is the activity which appeases your inmost desire. But as long as you think you are practicing Zazen for the sake of something, that is not true practice." I don't think better words could be said for this. So as long as we have an aim or a goal that involves improving an entity inside with characteristics, we are actually not doing true practice. Why? If we were to look into the foundation of this life as dukkha, what is it the foundation of this human condition of incompleteness, suffering, alienation, clinging, rejecting, anger, hatred, all these things that we see in us and around us. You could say that the fundamental error, lesion, difficulty, is that we all believe that we are an entity, and add to that an entity that has characteristics, because this entity is defined by several things: your body, your name, your history, your habit patterns, your desires, your hatreds, your beliefs, your feelings, your thoughts, and then also your awareness, the sense of being a tiny point of consciousness peering out at a foreign universe outside you. Somewhat dangerous, maybe many times wonderful and attractive, but also dangerous, threatening. So this is the fundamental lesion that Buddhism has always pointed directly at. So now we have another very famous Zen master. He was from the 13th century. His name was Dogen. And he had a description of Buddhism. He put it this way. He was a Zen master of the highest caliber in Japan, early Japan Zen. He said it this way. He said, "To study Buddhism is to study the self. To look directly at this supposed entity with characteristics. To look directly. It's a kind of inward looking. And this is what Zazen is. It's a kind of inward looking." So he said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self, now this is the surprising part of this. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self. What does that mean? Forget the self. Let go of the self that you always thought you were. This little entity inside, separated from a surrounding foreign world that self exists with or without you. And this entity has characteristics, many of which we like and many of which we don't like, and which we're trying to fix. So he said, study Buddhism, study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. To forget the self is to be enlightened by all things. And this enlightenment goes on and on forever and ever. That's a beautiful description of this path. So, I'll read you one more thing. This is also out of this book. It's a wonderful quote from a poet. I think you've heard of his name. His name is René Maria Rilke. Rilke was a German, or an Austrian, actually, an Austrian poet. He died at a rather young age of leukemia. But his poetry was often described as very mystical. He saw something deep. I think he perhaps had a poet's enlightenment, you might say. Maybe like Emerson. But this is what he wrote. And the first word is actually italicized. So, in you is the presence that will be when all the stars are dead. I'll read that again. In you is the presence that will be when all the stars are dead. So I'll just leave it there, I guess, and open things up for discussion, sharing, questions. Anyone can ask and anyone can answer. What is the difference between a beginner and a very experienced student in Zazen? Essentially nothing at all. Nothing at all. Because there's nothing to be gained. There's nothing that you lack. Essentially. So if you were to identify as an entity with characteristics, plenty of things you lack and I lack. definitely. But what you are in your deepest center has no lack and only needs to be uncovered, not gained. It's not something you gain through the practice. So a very experienced sitter doesn't have it more than a beginner, or more than someone who's never practiced. So the Buddha had a very famous statement. He said, "Truly I gain nothing from complete unexcelled enlightenment." So the Buddha was this human being who achieved a very deep level of awakening, enlightenment. It was called Samyutara Samyak Sambodhi, complete unexcelled enlightenment. So he made the statement, and this is really remarkable, "Truly I gain nothing from complete unexcelled enlightenment." So now, you know, when you hear these words, and this is true for all of us, not just people who have never done this practice before, when you hear these words, you begin to understand Suzuki a little better when he says, "In Zazen, what you are doing is not for the sake of anything. It is the activity which appeases your inmost desire." In other words, you can't not do it. Once you're on the wavelength, you can't not do it. Because there's nothing else like it at all. Going to your center, letting go of thinking, finding out what you are in your deepest center, and how there's no dividing lines there. I'm not aware of anything else that does that. Maybe an LSD trip. But it's over in 4 hours, and the next day you feel terrible. You feel flat. Everything's gray. So the questioner was taught Zazen tonight, and one of the aspects of this posture, and as I said to all of you, the body and mind are not separated. Body and mind are not separated. So the way we configure our body and where we place our mind's eye creates a very unitary sense of mind and body. Now, if we, in our ordinary life, bring the sense of ourself being somewhere between our eyes, up here, and our face, and our self is up here, so when we meet the world, they say putting on a face to meet the faces that you meet, we become very self-conscious when our attention is up here, in the head area. That's okay. I mean, that's how you survive in the human realm. But when you come here, you don't need to do that. You're facing a wall. You're not talking to anybody. There's no one you're impressing. And there's nothing to achieve in this moment if you have the right attitude. So we allow what seems so natural, which is to have our attention between our eyes or in our center of our head, where our thinking mind seems to reside, and we let it sink down into the hands. So you ask me, how do I better do that? Do you have any tips for how I can do that? Because I'm struggling between my attention being where it normally is and being where you told me to put it, which is in my hara, this area below the navel, this center of gravity of the body. Center perhaps of some meridian, some mysterious energy in the body, which we develop in Zazen when we focus down here, called Jōri-ki. It's a Japanese word. It means a stable, centered power energy in the pit of your stomach. So what I can say is, at first, you feel like you're trying to juggle three or four things at once. But as each of these things becomes more automatic, you can begin to focus on one or the other without being pulled away from your zazen. So when you're able to begin to observe the sensation of thinking and let go of its meaning, and let the sensation just merge with all the other sensations, and then focus in on one sensation, which is the sensation of counting your breath, then you can at the same time notice that a part of your body, which is your hands, which is in this beautiful cosmic mudra, and which is represented in the nervous system in a very large area of the brain. So the sensory part of your hands in the brain is a quite a large area of the brain. The hands are so important to our ability to manipulate the world. But here we put it in a mudra. So we already have a great deal of sensation and awareness of our hands. So we're kind of letting it move away from the head and neck area and just sink down to another place that it somewhat more unconsciously is most of the time, which is in your hands. So we become aware of the sensation of our hands as we count the breath. And that's the very beginning of allowing your mind's eye, as they say, to sink down into your heart, because your hands are encircling the heart. So that's the technique. Now, it's not easy. It requires some struggle, perhaps, initially. But it will happen. And like anything else, don't make it a goal, don't make it a contest. Just kind of remember it. It becomes very natural because gravity tends to pull your attention down when your attention's not busy with thoughts, floating away into the meaning of thoughts on that slippery slope. That's a very good question. Another thing I didn't mention tonight is that when you begin to do this practice really well, I want to tell you this now, so that when you encounter it, which may be very soon, as your concentration begins to deepen, you will have some weird experiences, and I want you to just not worry about them. There's another Japanese term for this, so once again, we use the Japanese terms because they're easier to pronounce, but this practice has been going on for thousands of years. So this is kind of an oral teaching passed down from teacher to student, on through the ages. That when you reach a certain level of focus and concentration, you're starting to pierce below the floating on the surface of the water, so to speak, with the froth of thinking. And you start to sink down, you'll have some strange experiences. Very vivid, hallucinatory, visual things. Perhaps something sensory, hearing a sound or smelling a smell, or a very, very vivid memory coming into your mind, or a strong emotion that seems to come out of nowhere. The Japanese term for this is makyo, makyo, one word, makyo. It literally means, the literal translation, devilish vision. It's not so devilish, but it can be troubling, and it can be fascinating, and it can pull you away, and you can start to suddenly begin to think you're getting enlightened. And I want you to just come back to the practice. So don't let anything deter you from the practice. And if you know in advance that these will happen, then you won't worry about them when they do happen. Some of them are very unpleasant. Some of them are very pleasant. But they're just a sign that your focus is deepening. It's actually a little, I would say it's a signpost. You're going on a path and you're passing a signpost. Now, after a long period of time, these don't tend to happen anymore. They just go away as your concentration really deepens and you really get familiar with the practice and this deep space. They don't trouble you anymore. If they came up, you wouldn't even notice them. Just to let you know about that as something to be aware of. Don't seek it, don't hold on to it, don't fight with it, just come back to your practice like you would with any thought. So we've actually reached the end of our time, and we'll end here.